I'll just open this up by saying that feminism very much had that dream that Mario talked about, a dream of overcoming hierarchy in all areas of life. And what made feminism, second wave feminism in the 1970s, so radical is that we were attacking a form of hierarchy which had been assumed was just biological and could not be changed, and no point in even talking about it. And that we were going into that anyway, often ridiculed, but our vision went that far at that time. And we had a sense at the beginning of the second wave feminist movement that there was a possibility of sisterhood among all women. Yes, we acknowledge differences of race and class, and with time with differences of sexual preference, and became more and more fascinated by difference, but we always also had a universalistic vision that there was something that linked all women and made us a special part of any movement for social justice. And at that time, there was perhaps more of a basis for that sense of connectedness among all women than there is 30 years later. And that is that if you went back to 1970, you would find, for example, that the great majority, maybe 70% of American women were, quote, housewives. I won't go any further into those statistics about who was and who wasn't, but that was a pretty large number of women who sensed that they shared a daily life, sensed that they shared the same occupation at some level. I started thinking of this in very much sharper focus just about exactly 1 year ago when I was working for a maid service in Portland, Maine. This was for research. It's not just because freelance writing doesn't pay enough, although that does feed into it. And so I was getting just entry-level jobs and writing about my attempts to survive on those wages, and by chance ended up working for a cleaning service that sends groups of women, four of us at a time, out in uniform to clean houses. And it's very industrial style kind of work. And we clean floors on our hands and knees, as the brochures for these companies proudly boast. You know, you really do a good job. And so there I was on my hands and knees in somebody's kitchen while this woman, you know, talks on the phone and orders her other servants around and so on. And I thought, my God, or goddess, what happened to that feminist vision if I were actually in this role, if this were my real life as a cleaning person? What connection do I have with her? A person whose attention I probably could not, I was invisible to in this role, whose attention I could not have gotten, I don't think, unless I crawled quickly across the floor and started gnawing on her ankle, which entered my mind. And so that opened up the, where are we? What has happened? Is that dream of sisterhood lost? Along with the processes of globalization has come this polarization of classes. And can feminism or any other movement that has universalistic claims within any group survive that polarization? That is a question that arose from me on the kitchen floor.
Has this vision gotten lost? I think it has gotten lost, and that we're, in a sense, submitting to a certain pragmatism that has come to seem a normal way of life. I think two things have happened. First, that we're seeing a great gap between the rich and the poor, and that, in fact, the rich are hiring the poor. I wrote a book called The Second Shift, which was published in 1989, in which I argued that we're in the middle of a stalled revolution, that basically women have gone into the labor force, but not much else has changed, or not changed as fast. And then we've sealed it over, as if that's gotten normal now. And then the family has kind of become a shock absorber of the strains that are created when women change and nothing else changes. And that's, in a sense, kind of the old news. Now what we have is kind of two pieces of new news. One is that women now in the labor force are working longer hours. A recent study by the International Labor Organization finds that we average 2 weeks longer than the Japanese now. So we're on the train, and the train is going faster. But the other thing is this new class gap. and we're being asked to normalize that. Recently, a friend gave me a copy of a book that has come out, which quotes the second shift a great deal. It's called A Housekeeper is Cheaper Than a Divorce. In the acknowledgments, which are always interesting to read first, she thanks her husband, she thanks her children, she thanks her friends, and then 12th on down it says, and thanks to all the housekeepers and house cleaners I've employed, whose hard work allowed me to be productive and who taught me valuable lessons about what succeeds and what doesn't in managing household help. So imagine what she would have learned if Barbara had been her. I'd like to just read you briefly from her quote of me. She kind of borrows me to legitimate a kind of privatization of feminism. Here's what she says. Hochschild states the problem eloquently in the second shift. If there is one truth that emerges from all the others, it is that the most important injury to women who work the double day is not the fact that they work too long or get too tired. That's only the obvious and tangible cost. The deeper problem such women face is that they cannot afford the luxury of unambivalent love for their husbands. Okay, then the quote ends, and her next paragraph begins. Before the epiphany that led me to hire the 20-hour-a-week housekeeper, I had become so angry with my husband over my long, exhausting working hours that I seriously considered divorcing him. One evening near midnight, when I folded laundry while Michael read a magazine, I launched into an all-too-familiar tirade. My infuriatingly reasonable husband responded, "Fitz, I acknowledge that you have a miserable life. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, but you cannot solve this problem at my expense. I barely have enough R&R time as it is. What good will it do if we're both overextended?" He was right, of course, she said, to protect his own leisure time, but I needed some too. In a perverse way, his stubbornness forced me to discover the perfect solution, hiring help. That allowed both of us to spend our time in productive, enjoyable ways. The story has a happy ending. Our marriage did recover, and now my husband has become a vocal proponent of hiring household help. Okay, I think what we need to do is to talk about what's wrong with this picture. To me, what's wrong with this picture is it erases the vision of public solutions and the struggle for public solutions to transform the workplace, to get that shorter work week, to get family-friendly policies available for everyone, to get the minimum wage raised, to get public services available to everyone, and to make the housekeeper's job life a livable one. So for me, it is the privatization of the vision. It's making it seem as if all you have to do is make decision about your personal life, as if that's what feminism is. And in a sense, that version of feminism has kind of taken the microphone, and what we've lost is the Mario Savio vision of struggles for a better public life. So we can ask who these housekeepers and nannies are. Some of them are American, but I think the new news here is a lot of them are immigrant women. And in other words, this is where the globalization comes in. There is enormous churning of people around the globe. Some 180 million people aren't where they were a year ago. And estimates are half of them are women. Half of the legal immigrants into the United States are women. And the proportion who come in as laborers has gone up. The proportion who come here alone has gone up. And once women are here, they're far more likely than men to stay. And they are, in general, women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, and the vast majority are married. And the studies would suggest that the vast majority are also mothers. So the question really becomes, what happens to the children of the nannies who come from the Philippines or from Malaysia, other countries, to the United States? And there's a very important piece of research done by a graduate here at Berkeley, Rossell Paranas, in which she looks at Filipina maids whose children are left behind. I'd like to read you just a little bit from her study. She's interviewed a woman who is 34 and a college-educated mother of five, a former school teacher and travel agent in the Philippines, but who makes very little money, even though she's middle class. And here's what she says. It gives you a flavor for the story, the hidden story, I think, behind maids that this woman would hire. "Even now," she says, "my children are trying to convince me to go home. The children were not angry when I left because they were still very young when I left them. My husband couldn't get angry either because he knew that this was the only way I could seriously help raise our children so that our children could be sent to school. I send them money every month." And then she goes on to say that although this is a well-paid job, she sinks into the amount of the work and she finds it depressing. And then she says, "the only thing you can do is give you all of your love to the child that you're taking care of. In my absence from my children, I give all my love to that child, the child she's taking care of." So, you know, I think we've seen before under colonialism, the first world going in and taking diamonds and gold out of third world countries, resources such as that. But I wonder if we aren't now seeing that maternity itself and the kind of labor of love is also being extracted from the third world and used by the first world. And yet, when a woman such as this hires her nanny, she thinks, well, this nanny loves my child. And it's true, the nanny does love this child. But in a sense, it raises the question, and I don't think there are any simple answers here, of whose love is it?
That's a great article that Arlie wrote about on this theme. It's sort of the extraction of love from the poorer countries of the world and taking it to this country for, you know, upper middle class, affluent American children. I just want to add that it's also Americans, whether of whether they're recent immigrants or families have been here for generations, who are some way or another in this new servant economy. It's not quite as painful as leaving your children thousands and thousands of miles away, but I saw this with women I worked with in this maid service, that they were we were paid $6.63 an hour for our work, and which was knocked down to $6 an hour for 2 weeks if you were ever absent. And of course, the working mothers with small children were always being absent, so they had in effect $6 an hour. And this is 1 year ago. I mean, this is not ancient times or anything. And that they were just struggling with childcare arrangements, which means not having enough money, of course, to pay for a licensed, high-quality childcare center, but instead it's some kind of deal with your boyfriend's sister, which will fall through if you break up with a boyfriend, and besides, I'm not sure that sister is very good at really watching the baby, and so on. And the contrast, I sometimes had the job of dusting. Dusting was good because you got to look at every book that the homeowners had, often not too many, but
Stop and read them?
I didn't get to read them, no. But that there would be, I remember dusting in this house where there was a shelf full of books, was a young mother with two small, very small children, and there was the book on, the books on pregnancy, the books on the first 3 months, the books on the sex, the 6 months after that, the baby nutrition, and it was just this lavishing, and of course justifiable and, understandable lavishing of interest and attention on those two little children. Whereas the women I was working next to were nervous about what was happening with their children while we cleaned. To go back again to that dream of the 70s, of that feminist dream at that time of a universal sisterhood and all women advancing together, there were things we didn't work out too precisely, I will admit. But we imagined, yes, getting into the workforce, breaking down the barriers to the professions, but we also kind of dimly imagined that we would all try to win respect for the kinds of work that women had traditionally done.
Right.
That we weren't saying all women will be executives or whatever in the workforce, but we were saying we will have all these options and we will win respect for the work of child raising and homemaking that women have done, although it might not be women who continue to do it, it might be much more shared.
Right, and what I think we have seen instead is a market takeover of our sense of values, that somehow you have to be paid to do what you're doing in order to seem worthwhile. Now the market is double-edged, it cuts both ways, it both liberates women, but I think the initial vision that we had as feminists was not to join capitalist society as it was, but to transform that society. And it did mean holding on to non-market value, value of things apart from pay.
And I think a prime example, the number one example of how we completely lost ground on the idea that non-market forms of work that cannot inherently be quantified and so on, such as raising children, were valuable, is through welfare reform. And if you want to think of welfare reform as a part in a sort of globalization terms, it's the structural adjustment policy for the United States. You know, that there's a real crackdown on the poor, and specifically on poor single mothers, who no longer have the option of staying home and raising their children. The policy is now, in our society, beginning with 1996 and the welfare reform bill, that you have no dignity, you have no legitimacy unless you are making money. Better to be flipping burgers or something like that than to be raising children. And this, I think, is something that is not sufficiently acknowledged by the anti-globalization movement, as far as I can see anyway, is that so much of economic, corporate-dominated globalization involves women. Women as immigrants moving across from country to country to find work, women at performing their end of the work of global assembly, the global assembly line in Malaysia or Indonesia or Mexico, that we really, so much of corporate globalization is about changes in women's lives. And I don't think an awareness of this has yet come into the anti-globalization movement at all, that we really are talking about women worldwide to a large extent.
We should say it's not globalization per se that we're against. I mean, more communication, you know, of radicals around the world, great. But it's corporate-led globalization that we're really talking about.
Which has a mixed message, you know, for women, in so far as jobs of any kind can reduce women's dependence on and sometimes domination by a husband or boyfriend. That's a good thing. But it's another form of domination than that you enter into.
How do you envision a new politics, a new sort of collective action that makes sense?
Well, within our own country, as we see this class polarization develop, there needs to be more kinds of solidarity among women and, you know, and men, you know, feminist men, you're involved in this too if you want to be, you know, around, across class issues. And that means very simple things like women who are more affluent supporting unionization drives by women who are very poor, and I'm particularly think of those groups of women who are taking up, whose jobs involve doing the work which was once done in the home. And I'm thinking then of maids, nannies, home health aides, a very important category, and they have been organizing, certainly in the Bay Area and in LA quite successfully. So, you know, we need that kind of solidarity across class lines. There's other, you know, the anti-sweatshop movement is another kind of, another way of expressing that solidarity. Mostly when we talk about sweatshops, we're talking about women workers, sometimes children, child workers. So building and finding ways to express solidarity even as we see class polarization happen is one part of it. We have to do that.
But I think it goes beyond that. And part of it is this most elemental act of envisioning a better society, in fact, daring to actually have a utopia. I think that itself, the very act of imagining a better society, has itself been downsized and eroded, that both by capitalism on one side and by the failure of socialism on the other, that it's not only foolish to envision a better future, but even dangerous. I mean, what somehow to have utopian vision is something suspect. But I think it's just that Mario Savio was talking about, and we need a free speech, an open discussion about what kind of better society we want. And I think the one that Barbara and I share is one that doesn't cave in to the marketplace. My last book, The Time Bind, was about a company that created an enormously workaholic atmosphere where workers would say to me, you know, it's not that my boss is making me work hard these long 10-hour days. I do it to myself. We do it to ourselves. And it was kind of an ethic like that. Today, what I wrote in The Time Bind looks like nothing at all. There are companies out there, increasingly in the new economy, that have gotten very smart. You have to take your hat off to capitalism. They're very smart. They dare to have utopian visions. And what they've done is to basically build around the workaholic worker a whole little utopian community. So you bring them all to the workplace. You solve this lady's problem, not by hiring a maid, but by having a laundry service right at work, having a takeout meals that you can take home at the end of your 10-hour day, having your nails done. There are even hugging consultants that four hugs a day is the norm. You can do more but not less than four hugs. So the mall has come to the workplace, and also civic culture has come to the workplace. That's part of their recipe too. There's this new book out by Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, which complains about the decline of civic life, that we no longer have, you know, an active community life. Well, it's very active and alive at the workplace, where they're trying to get workers to stay put. They've brought not only the mall, but civic life, so that you have genealogy club meetings. You have Christ International has 1,000 different centers based in corporations, and interest groups of various sorts. And as one employee that was quoted in an article that was written in Fortune magazine last January by Jerry Usim said, as one of his employees said, work-family balance, well, you know, actually we have it right here at the workplace. So what we have here is a new kind of notion of citizenship based around work. Who does this leave out? It leaves out the guy at the corner who's an eighth grade dropout, who isn't going to get a job or a permanent job. It leaves out the elderly. It leaves out housewives. It leaves out people who are doing a lot of people who are doing care. And it kind of, I think, impoverishes our notion of citizenship, which originally was based on civic participation, without a market takeover of it. In essence, this little utopian kind of bubble of citizenship that's work-based becomes a kind of gated community of workers. And the rest of us fall out of that.
Just one small example of what gets lost with this kind of emphasis. And I thank Francis Fox Piven, the political scientist and welfare advocate for this point, is that women on welfare in very low-income urban neighborhoods, in addition to raising their own children, which is harder to do in poverty than it is, you know, in an affluent community, were also the mainstay of their communities. They would be the people in the projects who were looking out the windows, watching, looking out at other people's children, seeing what's going on, sort of monitoring the community in some sense. We've taken that away. I mean, what we have done with this emphasis on everybody in the workforce, which in some ways feminism contributed to unwittingly, is take gut communities, gut family life, gut community life, gut such things as friendship. I get tired of always hearing about families and not about friendship, but all of these kinds of things get emptied out more and more, and then of course the corporations come back to us and say, and sell us little bits of this piece by piece, and next they'll be selling hugs, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I think hugs can be mechanized and they will be sold to us, believe me. But it's all, I mean, what we're saying is a need, and this goes beyond feminism, to devise the utopian vision for our time, which draws on the spirit of Mario Savio and what he represented, but is prepared to adapt that to a global scene torn by terrible, terrible inequalities of class and race and nationality. And what we're saying really is that involves not only the work of solidarity to build bridges between people, but also a different kind of vision, a vision countering the corporate capitalist vision of how people should live. I think that this is hard to do, particularly now, because so there has been the conservative propaganda of the last decade or two, well, the last decade, I would say, really, has been that not only is utopianism foolish, hey, we're used to being called foolish, you know, that's all right, call us fools, but that it's dangerous, that once you let your imagination loose to think of a better world, that you're somehow on the way to the gulag. You know, that there's been real pressure to rein in your imagination, accept the world as it is given to you. And we're saying, no, we now need, we're looking back at feminism and that dream, which we still hew to, of a universalistic kind of solidarity.